Everybody would, let's take our Bibles, open to Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 and 2 will be our scripture reading for this morning. And I'll be reading from the New International Version. When men began to increase in number on the earth, the daughters were born to them. The sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose.
Thank you, brother, for that very short reading, but very meaningful reading from the Old Testament in Genesis 6, chapters 1 and 2, which sets the stage for what we would like to talk about in our lesson this morning. As you recall, last week, we were talking about the various forms of media and the influence that media has on people, and how that we need to be aware of that influence and decide for ourselves what things are good and what things would be not so good, or what things would be wrong for us to engage in. It takes time to learn how to handle new technology when new technology comes along. And we talked about the fact that subtle changes in things that are presented in the media sometimes pose a more dangerous threat to us because we fail to realize them or consider them or recognize them many times. Media have a very strong effect on how you see yourself, your own personal self-image. And for that reason, I would like for us to do a little more concentrated or specific look at the influence that media has with regard to our concept of our bodies and how they look in the lesson this morning. There are several Bible references to the outward appearance of people. Some men are called handsome in the scriptures. Absalom, Joseph, David, other individuals. Some women are called beautiful women, Vashti, Esther, Abishag, Bathsheba. Of course, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, all of those are called beautiful in the Scripture. So there's a reference to the appearance of people there. But among God's people, these characteristics had to be considered, of course, in a righteous manner. First, let's think a little bit about historical progression of images. Early on in early history of man, probably the way that they got a gander of themselves was by looking in a clear pool of water, something similar to that, and that may not have had much of an effect upon them. Mirrors were developed. Polished metal was used for people to see their own reflection. Early mirrors were not like the mirrors of today. Mirrors of today have been very highly refined, and the art of making a mirror has been mastered so that it shows perfectly. The image that you see in a mirror today is pristine. You can see every hair that's out of place on your head. You can see any speck of dirt or lint that happens to blow in the breeze and land on your face. Mirrors are that clear. Printed media is another way that images are conveyed to people. At the turn of the century, lithography was very important. You might remember, some of you are way too young for this, and you may remember, or you may not, the famous Gibson girl who appeared in printed material late 1890s for about 20 years. They enjoyed popularity, made popular by Charles Dana Gibson and his drawings that were published in newspapers and periodicals all across this country. He saw his drawings as representing a composite of thousands of American girls, and she had an exaggerated S-curve torso shape achieved by wearing a swan bill corset. If you've ever heard of such a thing, you young people may not know what that is. Ask someone who's older and they'll direct you maybe to an encyclopedia. Images of her epitomized Western preoccupation with youthful features and short-lived beauty were portrayed by these pictures. Her neck was thin, her hair was piled up on her head. In the contemporary bouffant or pompadour hairstyle, which some of you hairdressers may know exactly what that is, without looking at a picture, the statuesque, narrow-waisted, ideal feminine figure was portrayed as being at ease with herself and very stylish. She's in the know. She's a member of the upper-class society. She's always perfectly dressed in the latest fashionable attire appropriate for the place and the time of day. You know, that sort of situation was depicted by these drawings. Now, for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about at all, when I mention a Gibson girl, maybe you'll know what I'm talking about when I mention Barbie. A doll that was created in 1959 that has enjoyed popularity even up till this day in our society. An American businesswoman created this doll. It was introduced in the marketplace in 1959, as I said. At the time, most children's dolls were representative of infants. This doll was different. It was marketed as a teenage fashion model with her clothes created by a professional fashion designer that worked for the Mattel company. The lady that created this doll, Ruth Handler, believed that it was important for this doll, named after one of her daughters, had an adult appearance. But early market research showed that there were many parents that were unhappy about the doll's chest. Around 350,000 Barbie dolls were sold during the first year of its production. And it was one of the first toys on the market to have an extensive television advertising campaign, which contributed to its great sales. It's estimated that over a billion Barbie dolls have been sold around the world in over 150 countries, with Mattel claiming that 3 Barbie dolls are sold every second. Barbie has become a cultural icon and has been given various honors that are unusual for toys in our culture, probably because of some contribution made by media. Criticisms leveled at the doll are based on the assumption that children consider the Barbie doll a role model and will attempt to emulate it even in physical features. Barbie promotes an unrealistic idea of body image for a young woman, leading to the risk that girls who attempt to emulate her will become anorexic. A standard Barbie doll is 11.5 inches tall. And what that represents is a 1-6 scale for those who are interested in scale models and that sort of thing. And what that comes out to, if Barbie were a real person, she would be 5'9" tall. Her vital statistics would be 36 inches across the chest, 18 inches on the waist, and 33 inches on the hips. A 5'9" tall female would weigh 110 pounds with those measurements and would fit the weight criteria for anorexia. In 1963, the outfit Barbie's Babysits came with a book entitled How to Lose Weight. And when you turned it over and read the backside of it, it said, "Don't eat." So you see why Barbie is anorexic now. The same book was sold in another ensemble later. This time it came with a set of bathroom scales that were pink in color, and the weight was constantly set on 110 pounds. Which would be around 35 pounds underweight. 4A59, female. Middle Eastern countries, in 2003, the Middle Eastern country of Saudi Arabia outlawed the sale of Barbie dolls, saying that it did not conform to the ideals of Islam. Barbie syndrome, which you may have heard, is the desire to have a physical appearance and lifestyle representative of the Barbie doll. It's most often associated with preteen and adolescent females, but it's really applicable to any age group. And a person with the Barbie syndrome attempts to emulate the doll's physical appearance, even though those proportions are virtually unattainable. One Russian model has performed a number of surgeries in order to specifically become a living example of a Barbie doll. These images are put out in the media. Now, what effect do these things have on people? And is it a good effect or a bad one? Photography is another way that images are put out before people. And if you think about the progression of photography through the years, at first it was very primitive. Only black and white photographs were made. Most of the time they were out of focus because the subject moved and they were to hold still while the cap was removed from the lens off the camera for a number of seconds to expose the film. But now, since that time, there has been the development of color film. So we have color photographs, and today we have the all-familiar digital photography that we don't really even need to have a camera to make a digital photograph. It's very pristine, very fine, and you can see every feature that a person has. You can do that with a telephone today. It's very easy to do that. You can take a picture of a female that happens to be a bride in a wedding, for example, and probably come close to identifying what brand of mascara she uses because the image is so pristine and so clear. Now, I make that point just to raise this question. What influence are those images giving to our culture? What influence do those images have on you? And is it good or is it not so good? You know as well as I do that if you're in the least bit in touch with our society, that people image assessments are commonly made. And our culture has used a rating scale of 1 to 10. A 20-year-old might typically say, when it comes time for me to get married, I want to marry at least a 7.5. I think that's pretty good leeway, don't you? That it would be a typical thing you would hear. Young people would list physical appearance as very high on the priority list when it comes time to think about a husband or a wife and what they're looking for in a spouse. It becomes so significant to them that oftentimes it takes precedent over other things. And sometimes this is a result of the deep subconscious mind and influences that have been latent in the mind for years. Maybe because of media images that have been flashed in front of our eyes all of our lives for a number of years until we get to the point where there are tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of images that have flashed before our faces and made an impression on us and caused us to react or think in a certain way. And we've developed those thought patterns, and this is what we're looking for. For example, a young man might say, I want to marry a black-headed girl. And maybe that's because his mother has black hair, and his babysitter, when he was younger, who was very kind to him, had black hair. But the blonde-headed babysitter and the red-headed babysitter were mean to him and wouldn't give him enough candy. And it left that negative impression. It just kind of was latent and laid there and not really thought about all that much. But those kind of influences were brought to bear, and maybe it brought a person to that point where he appreciated a black-haired person more so than another color hair. If all I see being appreciated in the media are images of beauty. What effect does that have on me? And what does that do for my concept of image as a value or as a selection criteria for someone that I want to spend the rest of my life with? And that's something that you really need to think about if you're single today and you hope to be married one day. The Bible describes the development of two different cultures, and this is why I selected Genesis 6 as our text in the lesson this morning. The Bible describes two different type of cultures there. When you start reading in Genesis 4, you read Genesis 4, Genesis 5, and by the time you get to the beginning of chapter 6, you're going to see how the development of those two different cultures are described and all of the things that the descendants of Cain become involved in and what their pursuit is. And then on the other hand, the descendants of Seth. And then when you read Genesis 4 and verse 26, then men began to call on the name of the Lord, talking about the descendants of Seth. And when you get to Genesis 6, it came about when men began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God, the descendants of Seth, who had spiritual interests, saw that the daughters of men, the descendants of Cain, were beautiful. They took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. So their selection criteria for a wife was physical beauty. And it didn't matter whether she was an ungodly woman or a spiritual woman. Their selection was, number one, the way she looks. And is that so bad? Well, read further. Then the Lord said, "My spirit shall not strive with man forever." And the text goes on to say that the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry he made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. And the Lord said, "I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, from the animals and from man to animals to creeping things and the birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I have made them." But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Noah was a descendant of Seth. Noah had a spiritual interest. So you see, the sad state of affairs that a society can get in when they put the number one selection criteria for a spouse using the wrong thing for number one. Something else should really be number one. What kind of forceful persuasion allowed these people to be trapped and lured away from God, the descendants of Seth? The one thing that God identifies in Genesis 6 and verse 2 is that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. It led to a sad state of affairs, didn't it? Proverbs 31, verses 30 and 31 say, "Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain. But a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her the product of her hands, and let her works praise her in the gates." Notice, let her works praise her. It doesn't say, let her cosmetic appearance praise her. Let her great beauty praise her. Let her works praise her. Her good works. Because charm is deceitful and beauty is vain. There was an old song in the 1950s. I can't recall who it was written by or even how the lyric goes, but it was about a pretty young girl and how she may walk down the middle of the street and all the cars would stop for her. But one day, those same cars will run you over. Why? What would be the difference at a time later? And there's a lot of wisdom in that lyric. The rule should be for us: marry a person who will help you get to heaven. If you're interested in going to heaven, you may not be. And if you are not, don't marry a person who is. You'll only drag them down. But a good rule of thumb: marry a person who will help you get to heaven. If you are a genuine Christian, you find a genuine Christian to marry. And your chances of survival spiritually will be much greater if that's the case. You know, media teach us a message by all the images that they put out before us. And that message is that I must look good. Now, I must do all that I possibly can to look as best I can, I think. You probably feel that way too. But you're not interested in doing that so that you may rate a certain number on a scale, are you? I think you should look your best. But don't misunderstand what I'm saying right here. I'm not saying that it's sinful or wrong for a person to do something with their appearance to improve it and to look your best. I think that you should look your best for the benefit of others and not so much for yourself. Because if it's all about you, there's a danger in becoming proud, filled with pride, a feeling of self-importance that you get because of the way that you look, because of the physical features that God has blessed you with that are totally beyond your control. You didn't have anything to do with the way that you look. That's what God has given you in this life. But be careful not to evaluate yourself on the wrong basis. How are we to evaluate ourselves? By physical appearance or by what's in the heart? The cosmetic industry is doing everything in their power through media to reinforce the belief that you need to look as good as you possibly can. And not only that, but you're not what you could be. And you're not as valuable to our society and our culture unless you do buy our cosmetic products and try to improve your looks. Well, sometimes they might improve your looks, and sometimes they may hinder the way that you look. Men and women of all ages turn to the makeup industry to help them accentuate the positive, hide the flaws, and to stave off signs of aging. The cosmetics industry as a whole posted sales of, get this, $36.5 billion in 2010, according to Drugstore News, and sales grew 4.5% over the previous year. Cosmetics are mentioned in the Old Testament. Jezebel painted her eyes, for example, just prior to her death, though, in 2 Kings 9 and verse 30. Esther chapter 2 talks about Esther being taken in and protected and cared for by the king, and she went through a year's worth of beauty treatments of all sorts to make her presentable for the king. During the 20th century, the popularity of cosmetics has increased drastically and rapidly, and cosmetics are increasingly used by girls at a younger and younger age all of the time. Due to the fast decreasing age of makeup users, many companies cater to this opening of the market for younger people by introducing flavored lipsticks, colored lip glosses, cosmetics packaged in glittery, sparkly packaging, and marketed and advertised using younger and younger models. The social consequences of younger and younger cosmetic use has had much attention in the media over the past few years. Ask yourself what message is being sent by media regarding physical beauty and what is that effect on me? I'm just asking you to think about it because we need to think about the influences of the world that are presented to us day by day and what sort of effect they have on us. We can't give up walking in the light for what this world has to offer for us. Whether its influences are bold, being thrown in our face, or if they're subtle. and chronic over time. Media's message or interpretation of their message is, I'm not worthwhile if I don't look as good as everybody else. You know that message is in the media. This attitude leads to a low self-esteem among a number of people, a lack of social acceptance, pressure from one's peers in school or at work, bullying that has come to be prominently recognized by our media of late, and media influences are contributing factors. Some types of media have glorified and even romanticized suicide as an answer to this problem among our young people. Did you know that suicide is one of the leading causes of death among teenagers in our country? The third leading cause of death behind accidents and homicide of people aged 15 to 24 is suicide. It's the fourth leading cause of death for children between the ages of 10 and 14. It results in approximately 4,600 lives lost each year. And this rate is on the rise in this country, if you didn't know that. One of the reasons, not the only reason by far, but one of the reasons why there is suicide among young people is this: I don't look as good as others. Isn't that sad? What has influenced that type of thinking? Consider what the Lord Jesus Christ said in Luke 12, verses 6 and 7. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 cents? Yet not one of them is forgotten before God. Indeed, the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear. You are more valuable than many sparrows. Now, the Lord said that. And He said that about people. And He wasn't screening for a beauty contest when He said it. He didn't have the outward appearance of anyone in mind when He made that statement. He was talking to people who were generally rough and poor and didn't have what they needed to purchase cosmetics, more than likely. And He said of them, you are more valuable than many sparrows. Media teach a different message, message from the Bible with regard even to the subject of death. Some people know nothing at all about death. Don't want to have anything to do with it. Never been to a funeral home. Have no plans to go until their own death. Then they shy away from that subject because they can't handle it. It's God's plan in the Bible for people to die. That's part of what God's plan is for us at the present time. If you are given a short time here to decide who you are going to live for, and who you are going to live with when this very short life is over. Thinking about death is not going to destroy you. As a matter of fact, the wisest man said in Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 2 that it's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man. It's better to go to a funeral home than a party house, he says, because it's the end of every man, and you see it at the funeral home. And the living takes it to heart, he goes on to say. You take it to heart when you walk into a house where death has visited recently. There are serious lessons about life and death that we need to learn, and need to learn from the Word of God. We're most receptive to learning them when we can approach the subject seriously. And we can approach the subject seriously when we're at the funeral home, because it's brought to bear very heavily on our shoulders. Media teach me that I don't know about death and I can't handle death. But the Bible shows me that my body is really not who I am. Who I am is who I am on the inside of this body. And this body that I wear is just a tent. It's just a tabernacle. It's just a temporary dwelling place. In Genesis 3, in verse 19, Adam was told that by the sweat of your brow you'll eat bread till you return to the ground, but because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. He's talking about his physical body. Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 7, then dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. In James 2 and verse 26, the body without the spirit is dead. The physical body will decay. If we put all our stock in the physical body, we're putting our stock in everything that's going to one day decay and flitter away and rot in a grave. Must we not then consider the spirit of man and what's on the inside of man and how important it is and how it must take priority over our physical appearance? The Bible teaches that people will live on after death, having been separated from the body. Beloved, we are children of God, and it has not yet appeared what we shall be, John wrote in 1 John 3 and verse 2. We know that when He appears, we will be like Him, because we will see Him just as He is. And that wonderful passage on the resurrection in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 teaches us that we must put off this mortal body in order to be clothed from on high with an immortal body that will never decay, that will live forever. Media teach that there's no way to control the feelings and urges of this body. The classic mythology presents Cupid as the god of desire, the god of erotic love, the god of attraction, the god of affection, and he's often portrayed as the son of the love goddess Venus. He acquired a bow and arrow that represent his source of power, and a person, or even a deity, who is shot by Cupid's arrow is filled with an uncontrollable desire. Now, you know people in our country accept that as truth and refer so very many times to their uncontrollable desire as if the desires were never meant to be controlled. People bring themselves to believe they cannot control their desires, and the media are here to help enforce that belief. They have fed their hearts enough through repetition, through fantasies, through imaginations, through desires, enough times that they settle into this valley of belief that all of my desires are unable to be controlled. The Bible admonishes us to control the desires of the body, and it gives us the power to do so. Jesus Christ is the example of control in every area. If you think about the crucifixion, which we just remembered in the Lord's Supper, what do you suppose the strongest desires of Jesus was when he was being crucified? We're told by medical people that the strongest desire that a person has is to breathe air. Can you imagine how difficult it was being nailed to a piece of wood hanging there by your arms? Can you imagine how difficult and painful it was for him to take a breath of air? Medical people tell us that the second strongest desire is for water. Can you imagine what our Lord went through, suffering, dying on the cross in that condition? And we fight with ourselves about all kinds of other desires that plague our physical bodies, and we think, because the media taught us, that we cannot control those. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 6, beginning in verse 12, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be mastered by anything, Paul said. Food's for the stomach and the stomach's for food, but God will do away with both of them. Yet the body is not for immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. Now, that's one passage of many that could be given to show that the Bible confirms that man can and that man has the responsibility, the capability and the responsibility to control himself. And that he must do. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. Paul wrote by illustration in 1 Corinthians 9, beginning in verse 25, they do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable one. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air, but I discipline my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. You see what Paul's saying his approach to his physical body was? He didn't say, Cupid struck me and I have uncontrolled desires and no man can ever control them. That is not what he preached. He preached discipline. He preached discipline of his body and self-control so that he would not be disqualified when it came to be evaluated by the Lord. Media teaches us such an unbalanced view of our bodies. And we should find a proper balance in looking at ourselves. We should, for example, avoid falling off into the area that some call a hypochondriac, over-concerned about your health issues and the accompanying depression of mind that is so often centered around imaginary physical ailments, even suffering delusions of physical disease. Every twitch becomes a pain. Every pain becomes a condition. Every repetition becomes a syndrome. Every warmth becomes a fever. Every chill becomes a flu. Every cough becomes bronchitis or pneumonia. And these type of people are misreading every message of the body, and they're pumping their life savings into doctors and medicine to treat them for those conditions. On the other hand, there's another extreme of the tough guy. And you see him, and he's got a gash about 6 inches long on his arm, and you can see his bone protruding where his bone is broken. I'm going to spray a little Bactine on that and wrap it up with a rag. It'll be all right. I haven't been to the doctor in 40 years, and I don't intend on going now. And that's the other extreme of what it is. Do you know if you're living on one of those extremes? Or you have a more balanced view? And what is media telling you? All of the time. How do you age gracefully in this life? Can you do it? How do you do that? Some become imbalanced and determined to fight tooth and nail, looking for the fountain of youth. Some take exercising to an extreme, health foods to an extreme. I'm not saying don't eat good. I'm not saying don't exercise. I'm saying there are extremes that people go to, and media is there to push you along and help you every step of the way. If you don't die young, you're going to grow old. And when you do, some part of your body is going to wear out, and that's not totally bad. That's not totally bad. If your body wears out and you're on the path to hell, you have more trouble than you know about. But if your body wears out and you're a Christian and you're going to heaven and you're walking in the light and you're striving to be a Christian to the best of your ability, there's nothing at all bad about that. Paul said in Philippians 1 and verse 21, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. And I think that's true. If you're walking in the light and you make it to old age and you are ready, you don't have the fear and you don't hide in your closet when your doctor says you have a terminal disease and you're going to live for 3 months. And you don't crawl away and hide somewhere. You're ready to face that because you believe in God. And you trust in God. The Christian is not that gravely threatened by the prospect of death. We know that if the earthly tent of our house is torn down, we have a building from God. A house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Read those first 4 verses. You need that encouragement. I need it. Well, who are you? Who are you? And how did you arrive at the concept that you presently hold about who you are? And does it have anything to do with what media has taught you? Media have taught you. Does it have anything to do with that? Or does it have more to do with what God's sure and true word has taught you? And that's the question. Thank you so much for paying attention and thinking with me about these all-important matters that not only affect our young people, but also affect us as adults and may in an adverse way. If we're not careful, please be careful. If you're in our assembly today and we can help you to become a Christian, to walk in the light of God, we'd delight to do that. And if we can, please come and let us know while we stand together and encourage you by singing this song.